I think before we get into the what happened to the radio traders, I want to know about the whole concept that you talk, that you write about, which is about imaginary propaganda. Could you go into that story?
Sure. You heard examples of real propaganda from Mildred Gillers and from William Joyce. What's interesting to us about these broadcasts is they really sparked the Allied imagination, we found, that listeners started to name these broadcasters. They gave them the names Lord Ha-Ha, Axis Sally, Tokyo Rose. They started talking about what they might look like. You know, I mentioned earlier, I think, that Lord Ha-Ha, before he was identified as William Joyce, was imagined to look a bit like an upper-class twit. Axis Sally, Tokyo Rose were imagined to be very seductive, sultry women. You know, Tokyo Rose in a kimono, Axis Sally, a blonde seductress with a bedroom voice. So there was a lot of imagination about who these people were, what they looked like. And this imagination also applied to what they said. So a lot of stories circulated about Tokyo Rose, Lord Ha-Ha, Axis Sally, that they were able to predict troop movements, that they were able to announce before they happened attacks, and that they knew even, you know, which town hall clocks or which, you know, officer club clocks were running slow. And this was completely imaginary. These broadcasters did not have the intelligence about the clocks, about the impending attacks, about the troop movements that, according to legend, they did have. And these rumors spread beyond listeners to the general population in the United States and Britain. So the belief was, and the belief continues to be, that these broadcasters somehow had this wonderful intelligence that if you listen to the broadcasts, you know they didn't have. And British intelligence, American intelligence realized this during the war. And yet, these legends are still with us.
If I can give a couple brief examples of how this worked. In 1940 in England, a certain district of London held a fundraiser to build Spitfires. And to do this, they displayed a shot down Messerschmitt German fighter. And there was a bombing raid that came very close to hitting this Messerschmitt on the ground. And the people in this district of London petitioned the town the town council to remove the Messerschmitt because Lord Ha-Ha, they claimed, had promised to bomb every town in England that displayed a Messerschmitt. Another example from the European theater, one GI wrote home, and this is in the censorship files at the National Archives that Anne found, that Axis Sally not only knew, when I'm quoting here, what our jobs are in the general pattern, but also knew that they were at X, a location, censored, and were about to leave for X, again a censored location. And then, which really slew the lads, she told them the password for that night. So the level of detail that listeners thought enemy broadcasters had access to was very elaborate.
And why is that? How did that come up? I mean, they had all these psychiatrists who were looking into this, government employed psychiatrists. I mean, is there any speculations about what was going on in people's psyches?
The psychology of radio listening isn't that well understood, or at least we don't understand it very well. Perhaps there are listeners out there who do more than we do. But one connection was to rumor networks, that a lot of these pieces of imaginary propaganda arose because people started talking about the broadcasts. Another example that points out the role of rumor in creating these imaginary pieces of imaginary propaganda. From the mass observation archives, one diarist noted a conversation she overheard that an elder sister had pulled her younger sister out of a war production factory because she had heard the Lord Haha had promised to bomb it. So this was this piece of imaginary propaganda was generated through rumor and had no basis in fact.
Well, actually, another problem is that while American intelligence was aware that these rumors were false, that there weren't such predictions, American radio researchers and psychologists didn't seem to understand that this phenomenon. So you don't see it in the scholarship on radio research that that was being generated at the time. But I think we can speculate on some of the reasons why these rumors emerged. I mean, part of it was this is a pretty scary time, and people didn't know when they would be bombed. One way to try to control your fear is to anticipate what's going to happen. And so if Tokyo Rose, for example, can tell you that you're going to be bombed at such and such a time, you know, it gives you the time to prepare for that event. I think that there's also a strong feeling, you know, among soldiers, among British civilians, that they're not getting, you know, all the news. They're not getting the truth. And there's a sense that you can kind of triangulate, you know, you get the German propaganda, you get the censored British news in Britain, and you can kind of put the two together and figure out what's really happening. You know, the soldiers, again, you know, they didn't know where they were going to move. They wanted to know what's going to happen to them. You know, by attributing, you know, an intelligence or an informed guess to Tokyo Rose, somehow it gave you a sense that you had some knowledge of where you're going.
Now, the phenomenon, these imaginary broadcasts, was that similar, whether it's on the Eastern Front, whether it's in Europe or in the Pacific, or these occur in both places equally?
Yes. Tokyo Rose, Axis Sally, Lord Haha, all of them have imaginary propaganda associated with them. Another way that imaginary propaganda became hardened into legend was through popular culture, even during the war. One movie that we found was Sherlock Holmes and the Voice of Terror from 1940 or 1941, which, oddly enough, Holmes and Watson are still alive and running around 1940 London, and fiction, I suppose. And they are asked by the British government to locate and capture a broadcaster who predicts attacks as they actually happen. So the opening of the movie shows this voice of terror predicting a train collision and a factory exploding and so forth. So popular culture right away during the war picked up on these themes, these imaginary propaganda themes, and helped to solidify those into the collective memory of the war from that early period.
Another answer to your question, though, is that these stories are really stereotyped. I mean, you get the same stories in Britain, in, you know, continental Europe, in the Pacific theater, they're all the same. You know, so-and-so predicted an attack. So-and-so was able to tell us that our clock was slow. How did she know that? How did he know that? You know, Lord Haha, you know, just fill in the blank. It's Lord Haha, Axis Sally, Tokyo Rose. The stories are very much the same. The one difference, though, is Axis Sally and Tokyo Rose harp on the theme of infidelity a great deal. I don't think I've ever seen a Lord Haha rumor that talks on that topic, but it probably isn't surprising because Axis Sally and Tokyo Rose are primarily broadcasting to an audience of American GIs, whereas Haha is broadcasting to both soldiers and to civilians.
That was one of my questions in terms of who was listening. Were there very many broadcasts where they would be listening both on the war front, the GIs, and on the home front?
That was probably more true for broadcasts to England, because given the short geographic distance between Germany and England, those broadcasts were aimed at British civilians as well as British and Allied troops. There are pieces of imaginary propaganda that American veterans tell about Lord Haha. Again, the same themes, the town hall clock running slow, welcoming Jimmy Stewart to a particular unit, naming the commanding officers. There's a movie called 12 O'Clock High, which came out after the war, that deals or shows Lord Haha predicting bombing raids that the American 8th Air Force is going to launch and so forth. Axis Sally, a German broadcast to Americans, tended to be over shortwave to reach the American homeland. And in the Pacific, Tokyo Rose or Radio Tokyo broadcasts were also over shortwave because of the greater distances involved in the Pacific. Japanese broadcasts had a lot more trouble because of the distance reaching the continental United States. So Radio Tokyo broadcasts were typically to American or Allied troops.
Well, with these broadcasts and the impact that they had on the soldier, the potential impact that they had, either imaginary or real impact, because it looks like the it sounds like the imaginary impact was much more serious than the real impact. There's something here about there's something for us to learn about oral history when you talk about imaginary broadcasts, and that is the memory of these events, the memory of what people heard, is obviously distorted. And I know that scholars and lay people have, a number of them, have been somewhat skeptical of oral history because they said, well, we can't really trust what people remember. And this is kind of an example of when you can't trust what people remember. But on the other hand, there is something that's real there in the misremembering of these events, isn't there?
Yes. Again, in my experience dealing with students who worked at the Oral History Project at Rutgers, there is a tendency on the part of the public, large parts of the public, to regard oral histories uncritically, to think that oral histories reveal unvarnished, unmediated access to lived experience. A good way to think about oral history is that it's a source like any other source. And using oral history accounts should also be used alongside other types of evidence, whether it's archival research, these broadcasts themselves, and so forth. So to get a true picture of what was happening, you need to check oral history against other kinds of sources and treat oral history as critically as you would treat any other source. As far as the memory aspect and why GIs would misremember what they heard, they were also misremembering what they heard immediately after they heard these broadcasts. And that's clear from the GI letters that Anne found in the National Archives, as well as other contemporary accounts. But for a GI interviewed, say, 40, 50, or 60 years after the war, part of the reason that somebody might misremember these broadcasts is the personalized nature of what they remembered, that they remembered their units being named specifically, they remembered being threatened with attacks, and so forth. So it personalizes the war experience for them, I think, and I'm speculating here, but I think it personalizes their wartime experience in a way that few other episodes might do.
But what I'm getting at with my original question, and you were getting it too, that we need to treat oral history in a much more sophisticated way, so that when we read and when we recognize by comparing one source with another source that some distortion is taking place, then the subject becomes the nature of that distortion, the logic of that distortion, the reasons for that distortion, and that is also part of history. That is also giving us information about the trauma of the war and the impact that trauma had on soldiers and on civilians. And why is it that people misremembered in a particular way as opposed to another way?
And so many of them, and so consistently.
Exactly.
I agree. I think there's a real emotional truth to these memories. They might not be telling the truth of what actually happened, but there is an emotional truth to it. You know, you get a sense of, you know, servicemen's fear, a British civilian's fear of attack. I mean, this is a way of expressing that fear. And in fact, a way of kind of displacing it. Well, we were told to be fearful heading into battle. And, you know, that's a way to express it and almost dismiss it. So, for example, Flags of Our Father includes a Tokyo Rose broadcast, you know, on the ship heading toward battle. It's also a way of promoting your unit's wartime experience. We were so important that Tokyo Rose, Axis Sally, knew who we were, what we were doing. You know, German military intelligence was tracking our movements. And in fact, a lot of units take a great deal of pride, a lot of veterans take a great deal of pride in having purportedly been recognized by Tokyo Rose or Axis Sally. We were called the Butchers. In fact, there's a letter at the National Archives in the sound recording section in the Tokyo Rose file of a veteran who wanted to get that recording. A veteran of the 41st Infantry Division wrote to the National Archives because he wanted a recording of the of this tape, of this broadcast where Tokyo Rose called his unit the Butchers. And part of this, if you look at some of the memoirs from the 41st Infantry Division, was a feeling that they were doing all this work and that the American press wasn't recognizing them. But Tokyo Rose had. And so, you know, if you're in the Pacific Theater, you're suffering, you know, the heat, the disease, the insects, and you don't have a lot of the comforts that were available to men in other in other locations. You know, this is a way to say, you know, what we're doing is important, even if other people don't seem to be paying attention to us.
We don't have a lot of time left, and I wish we could pursue this in more detail, but I want to end on what happened to these traitors. So I thought maybe you can tell us we have about 4 minutes or so.
Oh, and we didn't even get to listen to Iva Deguri.
No, we didn't, and I'm sorry. I don't think we're going to get to it. I want to hear what happened.
Well, Iva Deguri is actually the most spectacular case because she was convicted of treason after the war on the basis of perjured testimony, and Walter Winchell, the newspaper columnist, was instrumental in drumming up the charges against her and motivating public opinion. She served her jail time in the same prison as Mildred Gillers. After her release, she returned to Chicago, where she had some family. And President Ford, before he left office, granted her a pardon, again, because she was convicted on the basis of perjured testimony.
The other thing I should add is that veterans who were ear witnesses served as witnesses against her during her treason trial and actually contributed a great deal of legitimacy to the case against her. As Dave mentioned, Axis Sally was also convicted of treason. The two women served the jail sentences together. And Lord Haha, although he was an American citizen, was executed by the British government in January 1946.
Wow. Well, I wish we could go into the details of the trials.
There's so much here with the trials and with the whole subject, but we'll definitely have, obviously, the audio and a lot of links to additional background information, as always, on the website, talkinghistory.org.
But we're going to break with tradition today, though, because we do want to hear Deguri. And so rather than have our intro and extra music playing, we're going to go out with her broadcast. How's that?
Great.
Lovely. Okay.
And before we do that, I just want to thank Dave Hochfelder and Ann Pfau for joining us today live in our studio to talk about they both have interesting individual projects, but today talking about their joint project, Her Voice a Bullet, Imaginary Propaganda and the Legendary Broadcasters of World War II. So thanks to both of you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's been fun.
Pacific. How strict. This says after her weekend, Annie, back on the air strictly under UN hours. Reception okay? Well, it better be, because this is all request night. And I've got a pretty nice program for my favorite little family, the wandering boneheads of the Pacific Islands. The first request is made by none other than the boss. And guess what? He wants Bonnie Baker. And my resistance is low. My, what taste you have, sir, she said.